Welcome back, everyone, to Millwood and Micah, A Star Wars Story. My name is Amanda Millwood, and I'm a screenwriter, actor, director, and a huge fan of Star Wars.
And my name's Todd Micah. I'm the author of the Grimguard book series, and we have never watched all the Star Wars movies in order with anyone until now. If you've been following along with our podcast, then you know that this section is devoted to me and Amanda's biggest fandom we have mutually, which is Star Wars, but we've never watched all the movies together. So this is what we're doing, and we're kicking off today with Amanda's favorite.
Nope.
Oh, sorry. Amanda's least favorite. I didn't write there that clearly enough. That perennial classic, episode one, The Phantom Menace.
Yay.
Some stats on the movie. The Phantom Menace was released May 19th, 1999. Fun fact on this one, by the way, for myself personally. So my birthday is May 23rd. So this came out right before my 15th birthday. And so May 19th, the movie came out. May 21st, we saw the movie. And then May 23rd was my birthday. And right. My dad actually made really special, like, we have to see this movie right between, because we couldn't make opening day. We just couldn't. The whole family couldn't see it. So he was like, but I bought Todd so much Star Wars stuff for his birthday. He can't not have seen the movie when I give it all to him. So he made sure that we saw it between when it came out as close to the release date as possible, but before he like dumped this giant mountain of Star Wars stuff on me for my 15th birthday.
Aw, that's sweet.
What else is cute though is that he actually bought me a pod racing t-shirt. And because he wanted me, he knew I would love to wear it to the theater. He gave me one of my birthday presents early so that I could wear my pod racing shirt to the movie theater when I saw it.
Aww, that's sweet.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great experience for me. The Phantom Menace is written by George Lucas and directed by George Lucas.
You guessed it.
The man responsible. Yes, the man responsible for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the official IMDb rating for George Lucas's masterpiece is 6.5 out of 10.
It's actually higher than I thought it would be, honestly, when I was looking it up.
Well, why don't you take us away with some fun facts, Amanda?
Okie dokie. I was about to say okie dokie, Dr. Jones. That's the wrong franchise. Oh, good lord. Anyway, so fun fact number one. Queen Amidala's decoy is played by none other than our queen, Keira Knightley. During the filming in 1997, Natalie Portman was 16 and Keira Knightley was 12. And they looked so similar that Natalie Portman's own mother mixed them up.
Yeah, which is it's insane. Really different.
I mean, it's really hard. Every time I watch Phantom Menace, which granted is not often, but anytime I do watch it, I'm like trying to figure out who's who in every scene and if I can pick out Keira Knightley in the background when she's a handmaiden and all that. Like, it's fun. It's like, where's Waldo? Number two fun fact is Yoda was originally a puppet in the 1999 theatrical release. After successfully using a CGI version of Yoda in the following two films, George Lucas revised the 2010 Blu-ray release of The Phantom Menace, which replaced the puppet with a fully CGI version. That was a lot.
See, I don't know how I feel about this one, because as much as people saw the original Yoda puppet that they used in The Phantom Menace, and they were like, I don't know about this. Like, the whole de-aging him a little bit, and he doesn't look quite right, and, like, they made him out of different materials, so, like, it would be easier for the puppeteer, like, you know, Frank Oz, to manipulate him. He wouldn't be suffering from so much pain in his hand from manipulating the big, heavy puppet that he did in The Empire Strikes Back. You know, we made him out of Muppet parts this time. He was mostly foam and stuff like that. But you lose something when you change it. And there was a level of articulation with the puppet and lifelikeness that wasn't quite there with it. So I get it. And it makes it visually consistent with the other two films, which I guess is better. But I don't know. I still have a soft spot in my heart for the as they refer to him, the cross-eyed Yoda from the original release.
Ugh, I do not. I'm sorry. This isn't actually my hot take, but like hot take, CGI Yoda is better than the puppet. I'm not talking about like old puppet Yoda. I'm talking about like Phantom Menace puppet. It is so creepy looking to me. It looks like... It's like if AI tried to create Yoda, or like, you know, you describe to somebody what Yoda looked like, but they had never actually seen him, and that's what they came up with. Like, it just looks so uncanny valley to me, and I do not like it.
You know what's funny, though? This up in the description of AI creating Yoda would not have made sense to me up until last year because of all the AI-generated art. You're actually absolutely right. The Phantom Menace original puppet does look like AI-generated Yoda.
It does. I don't like it. Like, I've seen both versions, and yeah, I definitely prefer... And it's weird, because, like, I don't know if this is weird or not, but, like, as a kid and even as an adult, I kind of always thought that Yoda always looked like that, like, from the original. Like, he just was an old-looking creature that they... Yeah. I never thought that he got or was younger at any point or gets older. He just kind of is stuck in this
form. He's just Benjamin Button. He is just old from the womb.
Yeah, I kind of, honestly, so when Baby Yoda was introduced, I was like, wait, these things can, like, be young? What? I thought they were just born old.
They just come, just I mean,
materialized.
I mean, to be honest with you, he is just, like, wrinkly and, like, roughly the size of a small toddler. So I guess... I guess it does kind of make sense to think that he just comes out looking all weird and wrinkly and green and then just doesn't age at all. Yeah. The more I think about it, the more that makes sense.
Right? That's why when I saw him in The Phantom Menace as a younger puppet, I'm like, ew, why does that look so wrong? Like, I can only imagine Yoda being old. So, like, it's just weird. And then when they do the CGI, like, yeah, he moves better, but he still looks... like he did, you know, he still looks old and wrinkly and all that. So it's like, why did they do this? Why?
Well, this is terrible. I came in here thinking I was going to change your perspective on the Phantom Menace, and now all I've had is my image of Yoda ruined forever, as I'm just thinking of like him being born but old, and I'm like, this is horrible. I did not want this image in my head.
Turntables.
Oh no.
Wow. Wow, we haven't even gotten through the fun facts. Anyway, final fun fact, everybody.
This is us talking about Star Wars and trying to stay on track.
Yes. So this was actually my fun fact. Darth Maul only blinks 3 times throughout the film. I did not even know this. That is mostly because the contact lenses that Ray Park wore made it difficult to blink, and Park liked the idea of a villain who never stopped staring. He blinks 3 times when his lightsaber is cut in half by Obi-Wan, then a second time as Obi-Wan's lightsaber slices through him, and a final time as he registers what has happened to him before falling into the pit. And now I'm not going to go back and rewatch the movie, but maybe I'll just look at his clips only just to see if that's true.
Because like, I mean, he's only in an accumulated like 7 minutes of the film tops. So
it's pretty easy to look for a Darth Maul compilation from The Phantom Menace. Yes. But I never really noticed that, but I thought that was interesting.
I can't also help but think that there's got to be a YouTube video that's like 20 seconds long, and it's just the 3 times Darth Maul blinks, and there's just like the X-Files theme over it, showing in slow motion him blinking.
Yes. Somebody's probably done that, crazy fans.
Oh, I'm sure. Not like you've made any crazy Star Wars fan videos or anything like that, Ms. Miller.
What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Don't look for them on YouTube. Relo. But so anyway.
We'll get to it,
yes. And so now, for the format that we have that we're going to be running through, is that Amanda and I both have, for every Star Wars movie, a group of topics that we want to go into. We don't consult each other on them. We watch the movies individually, day of the podcast. And there's some overlap in like, oh, here are some topics I want to talk about from the movie. So we have our top picks for things we want to discuss. We also then have a section which is our problems with the movie, what our biggest complaint is about the film, and is affectionately referred to as our general grievance. Come on. I've been holding on to that pun for like at least 6 months waiting to use it. It's so good.
Remember when you first pitched that idea to me and I was like, you thought of that. You had to sit down and really think about that, didn't you?
I did. But I'm very proud of it. Very proud. We will, of course, as always, Amanda and I wouldn't be who we are if we didn't have a hot take about everything that we discuss. So we'll make sure we share those. And then we'll make sure that we last of all provide some insight into our favorite things from the movie, our favorite characters, favorite scenes, and anything else that we want to talk about that we loved about the movie, no matter how we felt about the rest of it. But why don't we go ahead and jump in with the, I'm going to skip right ahead to your general grievance, since it is like the biggest thing about us watching this movie is how much you dislike it. So why don't you tell us what is your big gripe with The Phantom Menace? Why is it, as we mentioned in the last episode, why is it your lowest rated Star Wars film?
Well, Todd,
this is your soapbox.
Yes, it is. I literally put in my general grievance on my notes, why does this movie exist? More specifically, why does this movie exist the way it does? And that might seem really weird to say that, but the idea of this movie is good. Like, it makes sense. But I think that the way that they executed it was just so bad. Like, it makes sense. It makes sense to learn about Anakin, you know, as a young person, like his environment, how he grew up and being taken away from his family to the Jedi Council. All that makes sense because it informs his decisions and his actions later. But I think that the way, first of all, and we'll talk more about this later, but the time that they chose to show Anakin his age is wrong. Like, I'm sorry. And I get what George Lucas was going for, that he wanted a child because children are, you know, so innocent. Has he ever worked with a child ever? I've worked with children. They are monsters. But, you know, he wanted that whole Jesus symbolism. Oh, the innocent, pure soul, you know, could never hurt anyone. And then obviously the ultimate corruption and him turning practically into the devil. I get it. But you still could have done that with him being like 13, 14 years old. In fact, I think it would have worked better because it's hard to come across a teenager that is not basically what Anakin is in Attack of the Clones, mopey and, you know, just so emo and I hate everything and my life's the worst and blah. But if you had a 13, 14 year old kid who is just so good hearted, so kind natured, and, you know, loves his mother, is doing the best he can to help support her and all that. Like, that could have been so fascinating. And then to have, you know, him ripped away from her, basically, by these monks to be raised in celibacy and, like, you know, on a completely different planet and not even bring his mother with them. Real dick move there, guys. But, like, you know, I'm just like, man, that would have been even more tragic in a way. Because, like, he's grown up much longer with her in this environment and, like, you know, they're at a very, you know, teenagers are a very different age than kids. And I don't know, I think it would have been better. And it wouldn't have been as weird with the romance, you know, because it makes sense for a 14-year-old to be crushing on a pretty girl that walks into your shop. Like, it makes sense. 10-year-old, I mean, it makes sense, but like,
it's like 90% of the problem you have with this movie just Anakin's age, because this is what it's sounding like.
I mean, it's not. There's plenty of other things I could talk about, but that is the big thing, is I'm like, why was this movie made like this? Like, I don't understand. It could have been so much better if you just tweak certain things like Anakin's age. That would have made more sense.
But what else? But what else could you tweak? What else do you look at this movie? Because we can talk a lot, and we will talk a lot about Anakin as a character, this being his introductory film. But like, so what other things are you like, why was the movie made, why was it executed this way?
Okay, the script, awful. The story, awful. The acting, stiff as hell. It does get better as the prequels go along, but, like, this movie is painful to, like, for the actors. I'm sure that they were all miserable. and then I think I actually saw a quote from Ewan McGregor about filming, where he was like, the most he remembered from filming The Phantom Menace was he would walk into rooms and he would look up and down. Like, you know, it's like, yep, yeah, that's about right. The just Jar Jar, not a fan. I don't hate him like everybody else does, but like, why is he here? like, again, I'm just like, I don't hate it. I don't hate him as a character. You know, Ahmed is great and all that, but like, I just don't understand what Jar Jar brings to the table and why he's so prevalent in the story in this movie when he's not at all in the other ones, which is a good thing. Don't get me wrong. Like, less Jar Jar is better. But yeah, just like everything about this movie. That's what my general question was. Why does this movie exist? Because nothing about it works for me. Like,
So I'm not gonna lie. From when we discussed this a bit before, this is not the only time we've ever talked about your hatred of the Phantom Menace. Also, I loved how like your hair was really nice when you first sat down, and now it's all like frazzled and lopsided. you're like in the cartoons when someone's getting upset and like their collar starts getting like yes. untied, like their necktie is getting undone, their hair is getting frazzled, and like their yeah, clothes start getting all wrinkled up. Yeah. So I actually was under the impression that you were like, this movie doesn't need to exist in canon, as in it's similar to the way who people who talk about when they argue about what order to watch the movies in, and they have the famous what they call the machete order, which is the original trilogy is what you start with, but after The Empire Strikes Back, you jump back to the prequels, kind of like a flashback of Anakin's life after you learn who he is. But then every time they do it, they're like, but not The Phantom Menace. The Phantom Menace adds nothing to the story of Darth Vader. You don't need to know it. So just episodes 2 and 3. I thought when you said, why does the movie need to exist? It was like a, we don't need episode 1. We can just start with episodes 2 and 3. We don't just film it. The film its story is unnecessary.
Oh no, it is. Absolutely. Like, that's my second. like, listen, I understand that, like, it lays the groundwork, I guess, for, like, Anakin and his relationship with his mother and being taken away and all that. And, you know, his blossoming romance with Padme, I guess. But all of that is done again and better in Attack of the Clones. We see, you know, we know that Anakin was taken from his mom and all that because he's constantly having dreams about her. And, like, you know, his, you know, dark side clouding his judgment, whatever. Right. And, you know, obviously he goes to save her from the Tusken Raiders only to fail, and that pushes him further towards the dark side. Like, that's all that we need in terms of, like, we don't need to see his life on Tatooine, if that makes sense. Like, we can gather from what we see in Attack of the Clones, like, what's going on with all that. Right. So, again, same with Padme. Like, yeah, he's got, like, a little schoolboy crush on her in Attack, or, sorry, in Phantom Menace, but in Attack of the Clones, he also has a crush on her, and he actually acts on it this time because it's not a weird age gap. And so, right. like, again, why was this necessary? Because he just had to meet her and then not meet her right. for 10 years and then meet up again? Like, it just, right. it's like literally a retread, but again, better done. I'm not saying it's well done, but it's better done in Attack of the Clones, I feel. So again, everything that we learn about him and, you know, Obi-Wan, and Qui-Gon being gone, he's not mentioned again the entire prequel trilogy until the very last scene of Revenge of the Sith.
So do you feel good getting that all out of your system?
No.
So here was the point. The point of me making sure that you had your soapbox on this, as we discussed before we ever did any of this, was that I didn't want the podcast, any part of the podcast, because Star Wars, we both love the movie so much, was never for it to be a debate between us, for any part to ever devolve into me point, you know, presenting some point, you feeling the need to counterpoint it, because that's not what we do here. But I want to make sure that you had enough time to say all the things that somebody who also similarly feels the same way about the Phantom Menace, my mom, for example, feels like agrees with like 80% of what you just said. She rolled her eyes today when I was like, I'm going to go watch the Phantom Menace, because she's like, oh, that movie, like there's nothing good in that movie. Yeah. So I want to, on that note, introduce one of my main points about it, sort of an answer to you, to sort of answer some of the things that you said about it. Now, as far as The Phantom Menace, the quality of the execution, the production, the script, I've got some things to say about that too in my own general grievances, because could the film have been executed better? Yeah, I completely agree with you. Do I, now this is in a way a bit of a hot take for me. It's not my, one of my official hot takes. But one hot take for me is that all of the prequels noticeably could have been done better, and I'll talk about that when I do it. The execution of the prequels leaves a lot of people scratching their heads sometimes. But I want to talk about the virtues of The Phantom Menace and why I feel like The Phantom Menace is... And I'll even go so far as to say that The Phantom Menace is not just an important part of the story, but I'll balk just a little. In some ways, it is actually a critical part of the story. Now, I think that my assertion about that, admittedly, would be stronger if the film's execution was better. So bear in mind that when I say this, I'm talking about The Phantom Menace on paper and not exactly The Phantom Menace in the film we got.
Right.
So the Phantom Menace establishes a very strong foundation of world building, certainly for the prequels themselves. And I will argue that it provides additional world building, not only retrospectively for the original trilogy, but it actually serves to inform the sequel trilogy as well. That if we didn't have The Phantom Menace, there would be things missing that are sometimes even unspoken references that we've just, it just wouldn't be there. Now, in the broadest sense, I say that The Phantom Menace serves to establish very firm things that are themes that are carried through the entire prequels. For example, the Jedi as bureaucrats. Now, this in itself is a big discussion point, and I don't intend to just monologue, but I do want to make sure I get the floor enough to kind of state this all in one breath. The Jedi as bureaucrats was probably one of the biggest things, aside from Jar Jar himself, that established Star Wars fans did not like about the movie. Because if for a long time the idea of the Jedi was that they were like monks, they were do-gooding monks, and everyone had this sort of like Gandalf version of them, where they were just sort of these wandering, you know, wizards, space wizards with their swords. They were kind of like, what's the word I'm thinking of? Knight errants, is it? Where they're just going to travel the land when you need help, when no one else is there. Boom, a Jedi appears on the horizon and swoops in and saves you, and then vanishes mysteriously off. Because and that's not unfounded, because the Jedi themselves are modeled after monks and knights and samurai and characters that in stories and cinema, that's exactly how they function. And so that's what the Star Wars fans expected to see in this movie, and instead we got Jedi as a bunch of people sitting around in a meeting room having conferences and drinking coffee. They're about as exciting as an hour of C-SPAN. So like, that was a big thing people didn't like, but having the Jedi as bureaucrats, I feel like, is very well established in The Phantom Menace, whereas the other films don't really have space to do that very clearly. And this is, I'm going to jump to the end of why I say this is all important, because The Phantom Menace, one of the objections that you have to it as a film is that it doesn't really matter, because all of the actual character story stuff, like you said, basically starts in Attack of the Clones. We don't develop Anakin as a character in The Phantom Menace. We certainly don't develop Obi-Wan Kenobi as a character in The Phantom Menace. Padme doesn't even develop as a character. The characters begin as who they are when we're introduced to them, and they don't really grow as people. Nothing. There's no character development in The Phantom Menace. And that's a valid complaint about it when you're looking at Star Wars of movie to movie, where's my character development? But The Phantom Menace exists not as a character development piece, and because it's not character development, it's discardable, that it's, you know, you can afford to lose it. it is essential world building because it takes the time to world build where there's so much other character stuff happening for literally the rest of the saga that you can never, there's no room for it. Example, the Jedi as bureaucrats happens all throughout the prequels, but we have a great chance to show it constantly in The Phantom Menace. When Qui-Gon appears in front of the Jedi Council for the first time, they're there immediately putting down his thoughts that Anakin is the chosen one. They look to each other like they're a vote, you know, whether it's okay to bring him before them. They test him, they shut Anakin down, and everything is very, very rigid. And the Jedi are kind of authoritative in the rest of the rest of the prequel trilogy for sure. But we have that chance for Anakin to get acquainted with them and immediately dislike them. There's no real room for that in the Attack of the Clones. They were mean to Qui-Gon. Qui-Gon tried to stick up for me and get me to fulfill my dreams, and these bunch of old people in chairs shut it down. And there's dedicated time for that in The Phantom Menace when there isn't anywhere else. So it establishes already Anakin being at odds with the Jedi Council from the get-go. That if we didn't have The Phantom Menace, how he's so at odds, why there's so much animosity and why he doesn't trust them by the time he gets Revenge of the Sith, kind of isn't there. It is there in so much as they don't honor his efforts in episode 3, but episode 1 takes a lot of time to show that even from a young age, he is literally taught that these people stand in his way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get it. I still don't like it, but I understand your point.
You're Lando right now. I don't like it. I don't agree with it, but I accept it.
Literally, yes.
Another one is Palpatine's rise to power. Here we see Palpatine schmoozing Amidala and with this real false, you know, kindness on him, and we watch him manipulate his way in. That again, we know where he came from. Could they have told us? Sure. But as a storyteller, I value people who can show instead of tell. If we had left this off the table and didn't have a movie that showed Palpatine maneuvering his way into office, you'd either have to cram it in Attack of the Clones, or you'd have to like throw it out there that he comes from Naboo and that's why he's tight with, you know what I mean? But here you can show it.
Yeah.
We have an experience that we go through with the characters, and now we bring that into the next movie.
That awkward moment when Palpatine is the most developed character in the Star Wars movie.
It's true. It really is true. Is Star Wars just Infinity War, but Sidious is Thanos?
Oh, God. Well, that makes sense because I don't like Infinity War either, so...
Okay, and now here's a good one, and I actually mentioned this at the dinner table tonight. My sister was like, oh, yeah. So, first of all, it is not true that Qui-Gon, and I'll talk much more about Qui-Gon because he's my favorite character in this movie.
Yes.
It is actually not true that Qui-Gon is not mentioned again until the end of Revenge of the Sith. He is actually discussed quite a bit in the middle of Attack of the Clones when Dooku has Obi-Wan held prisoner. And he says to him, it's only a shame that our paths haven't crossed. Qui-Gon spoke very highly of you. And Obi-Wan retorts by saying Qui-Gon Jinn would never join you because Dooku's like, I could use his help right now. And he says, don't be too sure. After all, he was once my apprentice the way you were once his. And and so he becomes this leverage point for Obi-Wan. Now, could one argue that's a throwaway because it's not like he's leveraging it to make Obi-Wan Kenobi fall to the dark side? No. However, it does establish that very much the way you can look at Qui-Gon in this movie and say Qui-Gon's death was the catalyst for Anakin to fall to the dark side because he wasn't there to guide him anymore, wasn't there to be a father figure to him. He's actually kind of the reason Dooku fell to the dark side too. Without a positive influence on him, without Qui-Gon being there, there was no reason for Dooku to believe that anyone was on his side about his suspicions about there being corruption. Qui-Gon is essential in this movie because Qui-Gon, it's revealed later, was one of the last good ones. That's why he is so different from the Jedi Council, why he's always at odds with them. It's important that he was around. It's important that he died. And it's important to know who he was because he informs Obi-Wan's character without us having to talk about it. So for those reasons, like, sure, it also does essential things like introduce planets we see a lot of in the prequels, like Coruscant and Naboo, for example. But it also does a lot of things that, when you really add them all up, while individually they may not seem like giant plot points, if the Phantom Menace wasn't around, you'd be missing actually quite a lot in future movies. One essential piece of dialogue, which I feel like I want to say is, like, super important to this, is when Yoda says to Anakin, fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. And hate leads to suffering. That is a theme that not only builds upon what we already know from the original trilogy, it carries into the sequel trilogy too. And if we didn't, and while sure we saw the fall of the Jedi in episodes 2 and 3, we see them again as this sort of lazy bureaucracy that also helps to inform what Luke Skywalker says in The Last Jedi when he talks about the hubris of the Jedi and how they let Palpatine come to power right under their noses. They were so dull, so bored, so lazy that they weren't involved anymore in the actual fight between good and evil. They almost didn't even care about the prophecy of the Chosen One. And so I make the argument that the Phantom Menace, for that reason, is, again, extremely helpful, dare say essential to the rest of the saga, but definitely to the prequels.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I would say that the only thing that, like, truly carries over into pretty much every movie, at least in the main Skywalker timeline, is that quote from Yoda. Wasn't that even on, like, one of the posters, like, I think for Attack of the Clones or something? Like,
oh yeah,
something, I don't know. But or was it, no, it was like the Jedi are forbidden from attachment, which is stupid. We'll talk about that later.
I think you're talking about Revenge of the Sith.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, but yes, I completely get what you're saying, but yeah, anyway, so, well, since we've been talking so much about, you know, the world building and all that, I'll just kind of build on what you've been saying, and that is actually a positive. I do have things that I like about the movie, and that is one of them. I really do love how much it expands the Star Wars universe, and not, like, and it's interesting because it's not just that it adds a bunch of new planets, which it does, obviously, it adds, you know, two huge places throughout the rest of the the prequel trilogy, right. You know, with that being Naboo and Coruscant, and Naboo is my favorite Star Wars planet, so I'm always eternally grateful that this movie spends so much time there, because it's just so pretty. And so I love that, but I love that we also go to a familiar place, Tatooine, and I actually applaud George Lucas for this, because it would have been so easy to go back to Mos Eisley. It would have been the easiest thing, but they didn't. They actually expanded the world of Tatooine outside of that one watering hole town, you know, town of Scum and Villainy. And we get to see a much broader scope of it, and I really like that. I love Mos Espa, and I love, you know, the pod racing and the Boot to Eve and, like, all these things that they add to Tatooine to make it even more of a city, or not city, but more of a planet than it already was. So, you know, that's all really cool. I really like all that. You know, I like that they created worlds within worlds, like with Tatooine, like with Naboo, having the Gungan cities, you know, in the water, like, that feels like its own planet almost, because it's just so well realized and beautiful. And, you know, it's very cool to know that there's basically an entire civilization living under the lakes of, you know, Naboo. It's really cool. So, you know, that all is great. And obviously Coruscant becomes kind of the focal point planet for the rest of the sequel. I keep saying sequel trilogy. Oh my God. Prequels. So we're doing the prequel, Amanda.
Get it together, man.
When we get there. Oh God, guys, just bear with me, please. This movie's hard. Working my brain. Anyway,
you suffered for over 2 hours.
Yes. So anyway, I do love the world building. And then another thing, just real quick, that I want to talk about, because it's probably my most favorite thing about the entire Phantom Menace, is the costuming. My God.
So good.
It is probably some of the best costumes ever put to Star Wars, like, period.
Agreed.
Just overall, like, obviously the originals are more iconic and I cosplay from the sequels, but like the prequels, that they have the best costumes out of any Star Wars movie. And this one in particular, like, just Padme, or I should say Queen Amidala's wardrobe in general, she's got like 20 different outfits and they're all incredible. And I feel the need to pick a favorite because I'm a huge fan of costuming. And it's hard because they're all amazing.
This is our like extra category. It's like favorite scene. What's your favorite Queen Amidala dress? I feel like this is a personality test. This is a BuzzFeed quiz. Forget Enneagrams. This is the Queeniagram.
Yes. Probably her black decoy dress, the one that Keira Knightley wears with the feather headdress, or the parade dress at the very end with the petals. Like, those two have always been my favorite. Obviously the red throne gown is gorgeous and iconic, but like those two are my favorites.
Yeah. So I love the red throne room dress because that's like super iconic, and I love the hair. I love the big hair.
Yeah, the giant bun.
and the glowing, like, and the skirt, like the glowing spheres in the skirt, insane. Absolutely insane. But you know what I love? And I think it's because we only get one single solitary short scene with it, is her outfit when she first shows up, when she's in Coruscant, and she's in Palpatine's chambers in like the kimono.
Oh, yeah, the kimono. Yes.
The kimono outfit is my favorite. She's like a delicate chandelier. It's like perfect.
That'd probably be my third one too, because I do love the kimono and I wish we saw it more, but it is only in that one scene. But yes, I mean, pretty much like I said, they're all iconic, and this is going to be a running thing for every super prequel movie. We're just going to have to pick our favorite outfits because they're so good.
I'm making a new category right now that is favorite Padme outfit.
Yes. Yeah, I absolutely love it. And not just hers either, but like everybody's. You know, the Jedi costumes look great. The, Chancellor Palpatine, well, he's not Chancellor yet, but you know, Senator Palpatine, his outfits are all great. And I just, it's incredible how much work went into all of their different looks and how they kind of inform, you know, like Anakin and Shmi, they're wearing these raggedy clothes because they're slaves. And obviously Padme is wearing these elegant, you know, regal outfits. And I just love how the costuming reflects the world and the characters so well, which I didn't feel, as iconic as they are, I didn't really feel that with the original trilogy. And I know that George Lucas said it's because he didn't want to focus on the costumes. Like, he literally said he wanted bare minimum costumes for the original trilogy, which is why, despite being, you know, a princess, Leia's outfit, at least in the first movie, is very... like, it's iconic, like I said, but it's very plain, very, you know, not fancy, not it doesn't give princess vibes, like, at least not to me.
But, who was she? A princess. And who was her mother? A queen!
The Queen of Naboo!
Are you saying it wrong? Grow up!
But, yeah, had to give a shout-out to the incredible costuming. It's probably my favorite part of the entire movie. So you had for one of your topics, we kind of hinted at it earlier, but I can't hold my tongue anymore about Anakin and his age.
Apparently, this is your biggest gripe about the movie. And you know what, though? I'm not going to disagree with you about it, because this is the part where I've done everything I can to praise the movie.
Right.
But it is a real struggle on this one. Many people have... lots of negative opinions about kid Anakin. He's annoying. Mm-hmm. He's whiny. Why does he have to be so young? His dialogue is really stilted. His lines are really bad. You know, sometimes I'm just like, why do you hate the Phantom Menace? What do you hate about Anakin? And they literally look at me like they want to hit me. And all they do is they say, yippee. And I'm like, okay, you got me there. You got me there, so man. One word, just one line, and I fold immediately like a chair. I'm like, yeah, you know what? I can't even argue with that one.
You're not wrong.
Okay, so let me give you massive amounts of validation. Are you ready? Are you ready after your long, difficult week? Just like accept it. Take a deep breath, Amanda. Here comes the validation that you ordered. So Anakin Skywalker is definitely too young in The Phantom Menace. This is not even a hot take. This is a fact. This is an established scientific fact at this point. As scientific as the midichlorians themselves, that Anakin Skywalker is simply too young. So just like you said, so many problems in the movie, like just the most simple thing that they tried to hint and kind of like plant the seeds that there'd be a future romance between the two of them, but like they did it in a really goofy way because they kind of tried to start the romance between them already with them being like cute and like in a really platonic way, kind of affectionate with each other and like verbally being like, I care for you. I care for you too. Like, I'm just like, stop. Kids don't talk that way. They don't do that. If anything, little kids only know people saying, I love you. He wouldn't be like, I care for you too. He'd be like, I love you. And then be really awkward. And then she'd walk out of the room. Right? But again, like you said, it would have helped if he was older. The age gap doesn't even really need to be there. So like, you wouldn't have to worry about like her age. He just needs to be closer to her in age, and it would have made a lot of things make more sense. It would have made more sense why he's so skilled with the pod racing instead of being just a gifted, you know, 9-year-old, which the more you think about them being like, hey guys, you want to go to see the jet engine races there at the old chariot grounds? Yeah, I got $1,000 on this 9-year-old kid. They say has precognitive powers, man. You want to watch him race around at like the speed of sound? How long? Like, it's so grotesque the more you think about it. That he's so young. And like, to address the reason why George Lucas made him so young, because you talked about it, you alluded to it, they wanted to make it more traumatic that he was leaving his mother, because at a younger age, he's still attached to her, whereas if they made him 13, 14, you know, you're already breaking away from your parents at that point. You already don't like your parents by age 13. He would kind of be like, he'd say goodbye to his mom the way he said goodbye to C-3PO.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, it would have helped a lot of things. It would have just helped a lot of things. I feel like
real quick.
What?
I just have this image in my head, and now it's never gonna happen, but I need it like in my mind. Imagine River Phoenix playing a 14, 15-year-old Anakin. Oh my god. The gravitas, the emotion he would have brought to that. Oh,
yep.
I need it. R.I.P. Yep. River Phoenix.
Yeah.
But, oh.
Well, and so here's the thing I would make the argument for, and this is going to lead back into a general grievance thing of mine, and I think it's also going to fold back into some stuff that you had talked about. I feel like, while we're bad-mouthing that the Anakin character was poorly acted, was he poorly written, was he all these things, the big weak link in The Phantom Menace for me isn't, and this is speaking of somebody who likes the movie a lot, I play devil's advocate in support of The Phantom Menace all the time and will to my grave. I think that The Phantom Menace script is 98% perfectly fine. I really genuinely think it is. That's only a hot take for you and me. I think that the script itself is perfectly fine if Anakin Skywalker was a different age, in which case only his lines that like make him sound young, the running around saying yippee, for example, tweak a couple Anakin lines, and like the movie is pretty much fixed, because that's only the really big awkward point, the big awkward point. But here's my hot take. Literally anyone could have directed this movie better than George Lucas.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
George doesn't... I love George Lucas because he created a franchise out of his wildly innovative imagination. The man is a visionary storyteller. he is so good. He is so versed in, you know, mythology and the themes of literature and storytelling that make a story that lasts for generations. No one can bash the man's genius. But Einstein didn't write poetry, and there's a reason why. People who are geniuses are geniuses in one thing that they're real, real good at, and not other things. And George Lucas does not direct well. He just doesn't. I get it. Like, for people who are purists, they'll constantly go back when I say this and they'll say, oh, but he directed the original Star Wars. So, like, you know, I'm like, well, okay, sure.
But the original Star Wars, even that interesting direction-wise, it's more the special effects that are pulling the weight. And, like, you know?
And that's the thing. Like, if you take off the nostalgia goggles for a second, even the original 1997 Star Wars, this is no masterpiece of direction. Like, you know what I mean? Right. The actors hated saying the dialogue. They did the best they could to make it fun and interesting and lively because they were constantly in rebellion against the way George Lucas wanted it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everybody hated it. And so here you have George Lucas writing the script, and it's kind of like, you don't really question it because by now he's George Lucas. He's like, he walks in a room and there's like a shine around him when he walks into the room. You know what I mean? He's the man who created Star Wars and changed the world. You don't question him. But God, the best Star Wars stuff is anything that George Lucas hasn't directed, because he's famous, as you and I have discussed in the past, he's famous for basically saying actors are there to stand in costume and say their lines. He just doesn't acknowledge, or at least didn't at the time, he just doesn't acknowledge that there's a human element that actors bring to the table emotionally. In his mind, he has a big story he wants to tell, and he has to tell it through people in rooms standing around and talking. That's most of what the prequels are. That's why they're such a pure product of George Lucas, because he has near total creative control.
Surrounded by yes men.
Yes, exactly. And that's when I say that he wasn't being questioned about any of decisions. You know, when you have George Lucas in the room telling people what to do and say, it all comes out sounding like the way he wants you to do it and say it. And the wooden acting in the flat line delivery, The Phantom Menace arguably being the most egregious of all the prequels for this, because that's it. He wasn't telling it wasn't even a character story. There was no character development. There was no emotion behind most of it.
Who would you have picked? Because, like, I'm trying to think around that time, you know, the late 1990s, early 2000s, who could have directed the Spielberg prequels? I mean
when I say anybody, I mean literally anybody. But like, and Spielberg was directing some good stuff around that time. I mean, this is when he made Jurassic Park. Like, Spielberg was doing some really good stuff.
Oh no, I'm not saying I don't know about Spielberg, because I absolutely adore some of my favorite movies are his movies, but I just don't see him doing Star Wars, and I don't think he did either, because I'm pretty sure he was offered at one point to direct a Star Wars movie. He said, nope. And I'm like, yep, I agree with you. I don't think he would fit, at least not, certainly not the prequels. You know who immediately came to my mind?
Who?
Ridley Scott. Can you imagine, like, if they took a, because these are more adult, quote unquote, like they tackle heavier topics, like, you know, political corruption and the fall to the dark side, you know, redemption, all that fun stuff. And like that mixed with Coruscant being kind of the main planet of the, you know, prequel trilogy, I could so see like a more Blade Runner 2049 type vibe with the prequels, especially in the second one. I think the second one, since it's basically a giant bounty hunt, like, you know, assassination attempt, and I'm like, this is so Ridley Scott. Like, he would kill this. Don't let him write it, because he'll ruin the writing, but, like, actually have him direct, and it would be so good. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's just me. I like dark, gritty stuff, so maybe it's too dark.
No, and again, I don't even, you know, I'm not even disagreeing with you. Here's my thought on that. I think that every one of the prequels is so different in tone. Much like the Harry Potter movies benefited from having a different director for the first two than who handled it later when the kids are teenagers. I really think, for example, the Harry Potter movies, the first two wouldn't have been as good as they were directed by, his name is escaping me for the moment, who directed like the rest of them plus the Fantastic Beasts film. Nor should the director of the first two have gone on to direct the rest of them. It just wasn't the right fit. But getting back more specifically to Star Wars, I mean, one of the films that is lauded as the best Star Wars movie objectively by many Star Wars fans is The Empire Strikes Back. Now, people who have fought soft spots for other films will say to the contrary, but you know, in general, people generally consider Empire to be the best film. One of the strongest points of it is that Irvin Kershner was the director and not George Lucas. Mm-hmm. You know, George Lucas wrote the story, but he didn't write the script and he didn't direct it. And
funny that.
I know. Amazing how you improve on the product that way. So, and as I say again, once again, for anybody who loves George Lucas, I love him too. But just like I said that Einstein didn't write poetry, there are things that people do that they're extremely good at, they're gifted at, they change the world, but they don't do it all. And that's the problem when you focus a project entirely on the work and the commands of one guy in charge of everything. It's almost like George Lucas through the prequels taught us that it was bad when you centralize power too much into one single person.
Mind blown. The jack of all trades, George Lucas is not.
No, that he is. That he is not. So, on that note, we've talked a ton about this. There's hot takes ahead. There's more things to point out about where we think a movie could be improved. And there's favorites, our high points of the movie that we want to talk about. That is, you know, the best that comes out of the film. This is the end of part one of our Phantom Menace discussion. Amanda and I will be back for part two
next week.
Yes, yes. So make sure you guys tune in for that. Don't miss part two of The Phantom Menace.
That's all for today. To all of our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, so feel free to leave a review or comment, follow the podcast, give us a good rating, and all that good stuff.
You can find us on Instagram at Millwood and Micah Podcast, and don't forget that our sweet podcast merch is available on TeePublic. Thanks again, and we'll be back in the next episode.